Meeting Judiciary come to order. Today is Friday, April 24th, 2009. The open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 42. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 42 comes here from Representative Bruin and Senator Devlin. It amends Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, allows local government to impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on the operation of new dancing establishments.
Okay, thank you. We'd like the mayor to come up with you.
Say that again.
We'd like Mayor Beekman to come up with you. Come on, please. And please go ahead in any order you like. Just identify yourself on the record. Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I'm Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37 in the Oregon Legislature. And this bill that's brought before you is largely brought at the behest of the request of the city of Tualatin and the people, primarily the River Grove area. And before I talk a little bit about the bill, talk a little bit about the history of how we got to the bill. Of course, we all know that we just got through a very busy campaign season last year in 2008. And I have to tell you that while walking and knocking on doors in the River Grove area, regardless of if the letter behind the voter's name said R, D, or I, it was near unanimous in their sort of angst over this a particular institution that was planning on putting a new dancing facility there. And it wasn't, Mr. Chair, it wasn't that there certainly was an aspect of a moral, but that wasn't the overriding aspect with the folks that I talked to going door to door. The overriding aspect was this is a neighborhood. And there's a school right here. This just doesn't make sense from a zoning perspective. Forget about the moral aspect. Forget about anything that has to do with that. It just doesn't make sense from a zoning aspect. And so, Mr. Chair, committee, House Joint Resolution 42 is designed to get at that. It really, I don't want to put on the record, this is not designed to be something that's some sort of a statement about the pros or cons. I don't want to mess with that at all. What this is basically would give cities the tool to say, hey, this is an industry just like every other industry that we have the right to zone, that maybe we ought to have some zoning rights toward. I mean, for example, if you're less than a mile from a school and in a high-end neighborhood like this particular facility is, you wouldn't put a chemical manufacturing plant there. You wouldn't put a heavy, heavy concrete distribution or trucking plant there. It just doesn't fit with the neighborhood. There's places where those things go. There's places where new dance facilities go. There's another establishment in Tualatin just across the highway. That's not the issue here. But this is very close to a neighborhood, a very nice neighborhood, and right across from a school. And we think, Mr. Chair, committee, that the city, any city, ought to have the right in a reasonable basis, and it highlights within this resolution, reasonable, have the ability to say that's probably not the best place for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator?
For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Chair Barker, thank you for giving HJR 42 a public hearing. Mr. Chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee, I appear here today because I believe the issue before you deserves to be heard. In the mid-80s, as a member of the Tualatin City Council, I sat through many difficult hearings when an adult business was locating in Tualatin. I'm familiar with how passionate citizens become around this issue and consider myself well-versed in their concerns. In the 1980s, the Tualatin City Council had very limited options for what actions they could take. Like the current City Council, we opposed the OLCC granting of a liquor license, but realized that our options under the Oregon Constitution were very limited. In 1999, former Representative Patridge, I, and many others helped pass legislation to refer a constitutional amendment to the people to allow local governments to regulate the location of sexually oriented businesses. That measure was defeated by voters. In fact, Oregon voters have repeatedly turned down attempts to amend Oregon's free speech clause. As we all are aware, Oregon has one of the most broad free speech expression clauses in the nation. Courts have interpreted that the operation of adult businesses are protected under this section of the Constitution, creating many challenges for local governments who want to say in where these businesses are located within their communities. The reality is that cities regulate many aspects of commercial development, such as setbacks, landscaping, architecture, signage, and even require different types of businesses within the same zoning area to meet conditional use requirements. The reality is also communities still have no way to determine the appropriate location for adult businesses, and very little capability to regulate their operation. This brings me to HJR 42. In the last year, STARS, an adult business, decided to locate in Tualatin. The city of Tualatin and the residents of the adjacent neighborhoods of Lake Grove and the city of River Grove have opposed STARS locating so near residential development and other non-compatible uses. The mayor of Tualatin, Lou Ogden, asked Representative Brune and me to sponsor the constitutional amendment as written that is before you. I know that there are parties here today, both in support and opposition to this amendment. I also know that many opponents to this change in the Constitution would defend supporters' rights to be heard in this process, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for their allowing them to be heard. Mr. Chairman and members of the District Committee, the issue that is before you today, I believe, is worthy of your consideration and discussion. Again, I thank you again for holding this hearing.
Thank you, Senator. Mayor?
Mr. Chairman Barker and members of the committee, my name is Monique Beichman. I'm Tualatin City Council. I am representing our Mayor Lou Ogden, who is out of state and could not be here to speak today. I'm here to ask you to refer HJR 42 to the voters in the November 2009 election. As you know, under the current court interpretations of Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, nude dancing is considered free expression and is not subject to regulation in Oregon. In the other 49 states where the First Amendment of the United States Constitution controls free speech or expression, cities are allowed to put reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on nude dancing establishments and other adult-oriented businesses. That interpretation has been upheld by the United States Supreme Court and our own Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We believe that the same type of regulation should be allowed in Oregon. We are not advocating any change in the Constitution that impinges upon the rights of individuals for their personal freedoms of expression. In fact, we say if you want to run around nude to express yourself, fine. But if you want to charge folks to watch you, assist you, or cheer for you running around nude, that is commercial endeavor and should fall under the same land use conditions as your grandma's knitting shop. We think that most Oregonians would concur with that premise. We are not trying to single out or wanting to put special restrictions on nude dancing. In fact, currently, they get special treatment. All we are asking is for the Constitution to allow local governments the same regulatory authority to commercial nude dancing as any other business enterprise. We are especially concerned in Tualatin because calls for police services to many nude dancing establishments exceed those for other clubs or bars by as much as 2 or 3 times, even if an establishment does not serve alcohol. Currently, we have Jiggles in our neighborhood, in our community, and we pulled the statistics for that. We had 102 police calls to that establishment that does not serve alcohol in the first 9 months of 2008. The calls themselves are made for a wide range of problems, everything from disorderly conduct to assaults to illegal drugs to drunk driving. Because of these problems, they simply do not make good neighbors for schools, family-oriented business areas, or residential neighborhoods. A shooting, which may cause close to a school, would cause a lockdown at the school. This affects the children. They have to be warned to be extra careful walking home from school to avoid becoming a victim of drunk drivers. All of these kind of problems are existent when we put this kind of establishment close to those kind of areas. We are not asking that nude dancing establishments be prohibited. We are asking that cities be allowed to decide where such establishments may be located within their cities, as they can with other businesses. For example, cities are allowed to decide where drive-through restaurants, auto repair shops, and auto dealerships should locate so that their businesses will not adversely affect a particular area. Under current law, cities must allow a new dancing establishment to exist in a commercial area regardless of a particular area's unique characteristics that make it incompatible with that use. We are not trying to put special restrictions on new dancing. All we are asking is for the Constitution to allow local governments the same regulatory authority for commercial nude dancing as any other business enterprise. We do not believe that Oregon voters intended in previous referendums to restrict their city's ability to keep new dancing establishments out of their neighborhoods. In fact, we have found that the residents and businesses in Tualatin, River Grove, and Lake Oswego were quite angry to find out that Tualatin had no authority to prevent such an establishment from going into a family-oriented business area near a school, their neighborhood, and a children's recreation center. We believe the voters should be given a chance to consider allowing regulation of these businesses. On behalf of Mayor Ogden and the Tualatin City Council, I ask that you refer HJR 42 to the voters in the November 2000 election. I'd also like to point out, myself and a colleague of mine came down to Salem back in December to meet with the League of Oregon Cities Board, and we asked them for their support in this, and they have passed a motion that was presented by Janet Taylor, seconded by Jim Lewis, to support the City of Tualatin's efforts on this issue. And it passed unanimously, so I just want to point that out. I also have copies of my written testimony.
If you would give them to staff. Okay, thank you, Councillor Beekman.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Andrea Meyer and Greg Chamoff, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. We are here today to speak about and in opposition to HJR 42 because it does amend the Oregon free expression provision of our Constitution. We are not here to defend any particular speech. Indeed, it is the Bill of Rights that we are defending today. As you know, Oregon does have a unique free expression provision, but that is not the only unique part of our Oregon Constitution. Our search and seizure provision and our religious freedom provisions, which are multiple in our Bill of Rights, are also unique and have been distinctly interpreted by the Oregon courts, and Oregonians are proud of that. You've heard, but in total, I wanted to make sure we understood that it's actually Oregonians have been asked to vote to amend our free expression provision four times in the last 14 years, and regardless of the topic at hand, the ACLU has opposed all changes. In 2006, the most recent one was actually Measure 46, which was the campaign finance reform issue tied to a statutory measure. Interestingly, the statutory measure passed, but Measure 46 failed in every single county. And the opposition to that was included the ACLU because it was amending our free expression provision. It also included librarians, Oregon authors, artists, former Justice Betty Roberts. And the message was clear. Again, Oregonians spoke for the fourth time and said, don't amend our Bill of Rights or weaken our free expression provision. So briefly, and I know you have it in front of you, you have Measure 87 from 2000. We believe that and the previous measures were all very clear when voters had the issue before them, that it was about the opportunities to allow local entities, local government jurisdictions to zone sexually oriented businesses. Indeed, the ballot title to Measure 87 was allows regulation of location of sexually oriented businesses through zoning. It is indeed the same package you have before you today. And again, that was not just opposed by the ACLU, but a long list. Again, librarians, authors, artists, poets, performing artists, musicians, art galleries, because they understand the important protections in Oregon of our free expression provision. And briefly, in 1996, the legislature also referred out Measure 31, and the legislative argument in support of that in the voters' pamphlet stated, the measure will allow communities to zone sex shops. Again, the issue was clearly put before voters, and before that it was 1994 in Measure 19. To be clear, local jurisdictions do have zoning authority. We do have zoning in the state. We have residential and commercial and other requirements. And it is so no business can set up shop in a residential zoned area. But what we don't do in Oregon is we don't zone based on the content of the speech that goes on inside the business. In conclusion, I think Oregonians have made one thing clear. It is don't amend our Bill of Rights. Don't weaken our free expression. We don't want government to tell us what we can read, see, and hear. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Chamoff.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine in Portland.
We are the attorneys for Stars Cabaret and Steakhouse. I also serve as a cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Oregon, working to protect the rights that our founders gave us. And like Ms. Beichmann, I'm a counselor of a city, in this case, Milwaukee. Although I'm not appearing in that latter capacity, I do bring those experiences to this discussion. First, let me say it's a privilege to appear back in front of the committee in which I started my legislative service in what feels like a lifetime ago. That was back when three of you were patrolling our highways in cruisers, and the representative from District 51 was patrolling his driveway in a trike.
Thank you. Perfect timing.
Article 1, Section 8 is one of the finest parts of any constitution in the world. Every constitution reflects the values of the people who founded the community. The people who founded this state believed that their organic law ought to reflect the belief that a strong people not only could handle strong speech, but that strong speech was good for a strong people. More than any other place in this country and in the world, the people have put into their constitution that the government may not tell them what they can say, read, or watch behind closed doors. And Oregonians, as Ms. Meyer has explained to you, still feel that way and have spoken that way very loudly at the ballot box. If harm comes out from behind that door and into the community, then the community can do something about it. And one problem with HJR 42 is it's using a shotgun to go after a problem where a scalpel, a very available scalpel, would work. Tualatin is asking for you to amend the Bill of Rights when Tualatin hasn't taken the steps that are available to Tualatin to protect itself from legitimate concerns about STARS or any other business in the community. A city has the right to adopt a nuisance ordinance that allows a city to move to shut down a business if the business causes too many problems in the community. What I've provided to you is a copy of the nuisance code that the city of Milwaukee has. If a business has persistent problems in the span of a month, three fights, folks urinating on walls, selling drugs, anything like that, we can move to shut them down. I've also provided you with a copy of the nuisance section of Tualatin's code, and what you'll see is it's 30 years old. It hasn't been updated to try to take into account any of the opportunities that are available to shut down any business that is a problem in a community. That code allows them to take action if someone's horse is decaying in a backyard, but it doesn't allow them to take action in the event that a business is acting inappropriately in the community. Now, what Tualatin has also passed on, and which ought to inform your decision on whether to proceed with this measure, is another way to work out problems with businesses even before they occur, which is to sit down and talk with the business. We in Milwaukee had a new business open, and it's louder than the locals would like. It's rowdier than the locals would like, and we are sitting down with them, with the landlord, with the business, with the local residents, and we are working out a plan so that that business does not bother people anymore. And the business will be able to go on its way making money and making its patrons happy. The neighbors will be happy and the city will be happy. 6 months ago, we invited the city of Tualatin to sit down and discuss their concerns, how we could modify our business to make it so that it was less of a concern to them. And we have yet to have the city of Tualatin take us up on that invitation. So our final message is, if you're ever going to consider asking the people to amend their Bill of Rights again, please do it only after someone comes to you to ask you to do it, has taken all of the steps that are available to protect their community and have shown they don't work. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 42 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2629.
are going to be moving very fast today, and we don't have a whole lot to do. Could you possibly go into a short recess? There's a police dog outside that I need to go get.
Okay. Committee, stand at ease for a few minutes, please. House Bill 20. We're in a public hearing on House Bill 2629. Counselor?
House Bill 2629 increases the maximum penalty for the crime of interfering with or assaulting a law enforcement animal. Increases the Dash 1 amendments in front of you. Also increase the fine for committing the crime of interfering with or assaulting a police animal. $500 for interfering and $1,000 for assaulting. We have the fiscal impact statement. However, it appears there will have to be a letter to the Speaker regarding the minimal statement issued.
Thank you. We'll have some testimony first. Joe Harrison and Jim Hogan, please.
Guys, afternoon. I'm fairly new to this. I haven't done this before. I'm here on behalf of my mayor.
And please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Joe Harrison. I'm a police officer in the city of Clatskanie.
Go ahead.
I'm here on behalf of my mayor. I have a statement for her to read, and I can ask questions later. Regarding House Bill 2629 related to the increased penalties for harming a police animal, honorable committee members, I regret I cannot be here in person to testify on this essential legislation. Please accept my written testimony in full support of House Bill 2629 pertaining to the increased penalties for harming a police animal. Our community has been experiencing increased drug traffic from Longview and local areas, drastically impacting Clatskanie, even causing the death of a retired Clatsop County Sheriff, Al Eastman, who was shot to death by a meth user. The community became more and more alarmed by this activity, so in the fall of 2005, our Clatskanie Together Coalition went to the public with an Adopt a Canine project. This community responded in 2 months and donated $34,000 towards purchasing a canine and equipment needed for success. As an outcome, Classman Police Officer Joe Harrison volunteered to be our dog handler, and we purchased a dual-trained police and drug dog named Ike. The Oregon Police State, Oregon State Police Officers Association even donated the vehicle, and the successful program began. Since that time, Officer Joe Harrison and Ike have been a marvel. Informants have told our police department that the word is out, don't go to Klatskanai because of Ike. This is exactly the outcome we hope for. This community considers Ike a law enforcement officer and tool to keep the community safe as possible from drug dealers, as well as being an efficient tracking dog and protector of his handler during arrest of criminals. Time after time, Officer Harrison and Ike have detected drugs in automobiles, buildings, and other places, resulting in arrests. One example is when a drug dealer had hollowed out beef sticks and packed them with heroin. Ike ignored the smells of the beef sticks and alerted immediately on the drugs. Officer Harrison and Ike are often called to all areas in Columbia County for drug detection and tracking and apprehension of suspects. To say this canine project is a success is to put it mildly, and this community loves Ike, even voting him Grand Marshal of the 4th of July parade. It's truly a public-private partnership that has a high level of success. House Bill 2629 establishes appropriate penalties for harming a law enforcement animal like Ike. As these officers become more successful, they will also become more of a target. We've experienced incidences in Oregon where criminals have shot and killed police canines, and there are frequent threats against them. They are efficient, they are effective, and they are sorely needed. We are sending our police officers out into potential dangerous situations every day. Canine officers are bred and trained to lay down their lives in the protection of their handlers and the community they serve. The very least we owe them is to pass laws to make it very punitive to harm them. They are not just animals, they serve and protect. For these reasons, I sincerely ask that House Bill 2629 be passed out of this committee with a due pass recommendation. Respectively submitted, Mayor Dan Pohl, Klatskanai, Oregon.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2629. I think, as you've already heard from Officer Harrison, and perhaps also have copies of correspondence from others, this is an issue that our community of Klatskanai has taken a great deal of pride in. The fact that the officer has fielded a dog that is one of the best in the state of Oregon. This program follows on the heels of a canine a unit that began in Vernonia. The police department there had a great deal of success. In fact, has been involved in a national competition. That dog became highly successful in drug interdiction, and I think it was by virtue of that dog's success, particularly with regard to interdiction with methamphetamine, that dog, by any other standards, was murdered. Murdered because of his success. And our community, Klatskanai, started a program very much similar to what had occurred in Vernonia. We're very fortunate that we have such a great dog and such a great dog handler and such a great police force. But we want to make sure that not only our canines, but any other police animal, be it a horse or whatever, who are out there fighting to preserve the peace in our state, is not harmed. And we cannot allow the citizenry, even the bad apples, to be able to go out and recklessly harm and endanger police animals. They are police officer. Ike is a member of the Klatskanai Police Department. We all love him. We want to make sure he's protected just like our other police officers are. So certainly appreciate your hearing this bill very much.
And I want to thank you, Representative, for the amendments to take some of the high cost out of this bill. The bill still has a referral to Ways and Means, which we're going to see if we can't get rescinded. But
thank you for the compromise. Certainly appreciate that.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name's Jim Hogan. I'm also from Klatskanai. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to be here today because I've been planning the trip to this hearing for about a year and a half. I'm hoping to be part of the process that makes things a little bit better for law enforcement officers, animals all over Oregon. In this, from the summer of 2007 to early 2008, there were three incidents involving police canines in northwest Oregon and southwest Washington that the animals didn't do very well. So it was, and this was shortly after Ike came on duty, and I just asked the question of Officer Harrison. I said, you know, what are the consequences for shooting or injuring a police animal? I really didn't like what I heard. It was pretty minimal, I thought. So I got on the internet, I checked Washington's laws, compared them to Oregon. I kept going and going. Eventually, 15 western states. I kind of reached the conclusion that there was some work to be done here in Oregon. I want to thank Representative Witt for introducing this bill. Our law enforcement animals need champions in the legislature that they haven't always had them. If you look back at the historical records of other bills in the Oregon legislature, you know, just one legislator acting at the request of one lawman. But so I'm encouraged that this bill, you know, some other legislators have stepped forward and put their names on it also. Since I think there's a heightened awareness of our responsibility to protect all animals, and including law enforcement animals, maybe we learned something from Michael Vick and Quintel Woods and those types. Since we only have two laws in Oregon that are specific to law enforcement animals, I think it's vital that we ratchet up the penalties and send the message that serious crimes carry serious consequences. We're not going to tolerate it. I don't think any of us have an interest in trying to fill the jails with people. We just want them to leave these animals alone and let them do their job. Whether it's a canine apprehending a suspect or locating a stash of dope or an accelerant detection dog working an arson scene, all of these animals are working for the benefit of all of us, and they deserve our best efforts to protect them. Oregonians invest a lot of money to purchase, train, equip these animals to assist our police officers in the most dangerous situations we can imagine. And I don't think we do a very good job of protecting them here in Oregon. I think we come up a little bit short. I know this isn't the right bill or the right time, but I think our biggest flaw is we don't protect these animals 24/7. We're the only state in the West of the seven closest neighbors that doesn't protect them around the clock. So I think we have to have that discussion soon. Yes, the sooner the better, and maybe move forward on that. The mission today is to encourage you to pass House Bill 2629 and its amendment. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for taking the time to come down and testify. Many years ago, I was a game warden in the Vernonia and Clatskanie area, and I would have loved to have had a couple of dogs to assist me up there in those days. And also, during my time in Portland, at one point I was the lieutenant in charge of the canine unit there. And I know those dogs run between $5,000 and $6,000. They're very valuable animals. They're bright animals and really a team with their partners and really an asset to law enforcement. So as I was explaining to Representative Witt, because this was marked with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, we won't be able to move it out today. We'll pass the -1 amendments, and then we'll get that rescinded and hopefully get that passed on Monday. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, Brad was smiling at me because he knows I got about 30 relatives in that town, and probably you were chasing them around up at the end of Sweet Town Road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holmes.
We've chased up there.
Yeah.
All the Holmes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bud Holmes is my uncle before he passed on, and I spent my summers up there from 1945 to about 1952 or
53. That's where we get our meat cut.
Yeah. Kind of funny. I'm gonna come out and talk to you when you leave.
Thank you, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, thank you for bringing this bill. I want to assure everyone that I am pro-dog, I am pro-Ike, I am pro-puppy. Just put some context. If this bill were adopted as amended, assaulting a law enforcement animal would be a Class C felony with a mandatory fine of $1,000. Assaulting a police officer is currently a Class C felony with no fine. I just wanted to put that in context. And we could make a lot of arguments. Maybe we need to ratchet up assault on a police officer would be the best argument, but I ask we be mindful of that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, next session.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification for the committee, what is the penalty for a Class A misdemeanor today and a Class C felony?
As far as monetary penalty, if you're asking me, Representative Cameron, I forget what the actual base fine is. Can I make one clarification, though? When I was writing this out, I did it at separate times, and I will apologize to the committee. The amendments actually delete the felony language. So I'm sorry about that. If anybody's reading your summary, I didn't note that, so I apologize for that. The maximum for a Class A misdemeanor would be a year in jail if a judge chose to impose it.
A class...
6,250.
Excuse me, a B or C?
Class A misdemeanor.
Oh, okay.
And maybe like $6,250.
Oh, thanks. Correct. And it looks like it's $6,250 is the maximum fine.
Okay, and then for a Class C felony, because the amendments still leave it as a Class C in for serious injury or death.
The maximum is $100,000. I can tell you... The way it works out is a little different. We have a grid. The grid system defines what you can legally, what a legal sentence can be. And so on a Class C felony, it would be listed on the grid. Technically, a Class C felony, the maximum is 5 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. That's an illegal sentence, though, in Oregon with our grid system. So I don't think I've ever seen a judge impose a $100,000 fine.
Just one more, if I may, just to clarify. So if somebody shot the police dog, they could be put in jail for 5 years and fined $100,000.
Actually, under the amendment, it would remain. It would remain the Class C felony.
Right.
So yes, no. If we got rid of our grid system, the grid block that defines how things are sentenced, then the statutory maximum is 5 years, $100,000 fine. That is not a legal sentence under the grid block system. So that is not the maximum. Now, if that makes sense, I'm sorry, it is confusing. I could go through the grid with you.
That's good.
Thank you. So could you just, from the beginning, tell us what this bill as amended does?
Okay. As amended, what it does is keep... Let me look at the original bill now. The original bill under Section 1, it remains a Class A misdemeanor, but it has an increased $500 fine the judge would impose. So then, and then on Section 2, it remains, the assault on a police animal remains a Class C felony, but basically with a mandatory fine component in it.
Okay, so the only part of the law that we're really changing is adding an additional fine.
The mandatory fine, yes.
Okay.
And that's why I'm sorry for the...
And that explains why there's no fiscal.
Exactly.
Got it. Thank you. Be happy to support this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move the dash ones into House Bill 3629.
Oh, wait a minute. First of all, opening work session on House Bill 2629.
Mr. Chair, I move dash ones into House Bill 2629.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash ones into House Bill 2629. Is there any discussion, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2629. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2894.
To be moved to 428.
Okay. 428. House Bill 2894 is being moved till Tuesday, April 28th. Close the public hearing.
And actually, did you carry 2629 to Tuesday as well?
Reopen the work session, House Bill 2629, and carry it over to April 27th. Close the work session.
Do you want to skip the next one? I don't see Lisa at the moment.
Okay, so down to 2403.
Actually, go ahead and skip that for now, too.
Okay. Opening work session, House Bill 2285, and carry that over to April 28th. Close the work session on it, 2285. Busy on Tuesday. Open a work session, House Bill 3343. Carry it over till April 28th. Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 2682. Carry it over to April 28th. Open a work session on House Bill 3264. Carry it over till April 28th. Open a work session on House Bill 2541.
I believe you're going to have dash 3 and 4 amendments being passed out if the members don't already have them. And House Bill 2541, this was first heard on March 4th. This requires a driver's license or ID card issued by the Department of Transportation to indicate a person may not buy alcohol if the person has two prior DUIs. We now have dash 3 and 4 amendments that I believe Representative Shields would like to address.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're trying to figure out where to go with this bill, and what I'd like to do, if the Chair is okay with this, is to move these two amendments in to make it a better bill that really, I think, will end up going down to Ways and Means. We'll get it into a finalized form and take it up again in February or in the next session. But I wanted to just have this to be part of the permanent record as a more finished product, and we'll continue on. I think we will need, since there's no fiscal statement at this point, need a rule suspension in order to move that to Ways and Means. But hopefully the committee will give me that.
Mr. Chair, I move dash 3s and dash 4s in the you're in the work session, right?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move House dash 3s and dash 4s in the House Bill 2541.
2541. Representative Wisnett moves the dash 4s, 3s, and 4s into House Bill 2541. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Now, wait. Stand by for just a second. We need to get one more person there.
I move suspension of the rules.
Wisnett.
I move,
Mr. Chair, I'd request permission to change my vote on adapting the amendments now that I just saw something that's in them. I just want to be recognized as a no vote on adapting the dash three. Is it exempts, it only isolates this to bars and taverns, and people can still go to a convenience store and buy the liquor.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cameron votes no on that amendment. Representative
Wisnett. Okay, Mr. Chair. I move the rules be suspended for the purposes of moving House Bill 2541 as amended to Ways and Means without a fiscal.
Representative Wisnett moves rules be suspended for the purpose of moving House Bill 2541
as amended
to Ways and Means without seeing the fiscal. Is there any objection?
I object.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Question, I'm sorry, this is on whether or not we're going to suspend the rules.
The rule suspension.
Yeah, rule suspension.
Two for the Paris. Aye.
You want to suspend the rules to get it done at those meetings.
Okay, aye.
Thanks. Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
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 Excused.
Vice Chair
Stigler. Excused.
Vice Chair
Rosen.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wissman.
I move House Bill 252541 as amended, referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wissman moves House Bill 2541 as amended to Ways and Means. With a due pass recommendation,
yeah, Mr. Discussion. Chair, I'm going to object. I'm going to be a no vote on just to make note that, you know, if we're really trying to do this, let's do it and not isolate this to just bars and taverns. But people can go into a convenience store. If we're going to check everybody's ID to purchase alcohol in the state of Oregon, then let's do it all the way.
Hey, thank you, Representative. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I also intend to vote no at this time.
Okay. Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
No.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger? Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative
Shields?
Aye.
Excused? Vice Chair Stigler?
Excused.
Vice Chair
Rosen?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
It passed. Yes, 6-0. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, the bill thanks you. It would prefer to die comfortably in the proper attire, in the proper garb, than, you know, half naked as it is.
Okay.
As long as you zone it properly.
Give me a vote explanation.
Go ahead and open this one and carry it.
Yes. Open the work session on House Bill 2537. Carry that 2537 over to April 28th. Close the work session.
Okay.
He is here. Representative Shields, is the party?
Is anybody here to testify? Is anybody signed up to testify?
No.
No, then you can close the work session.
Open a work session on House Bill 2679. Close the work session on House Bill 2679.
Okay. Don't carry it over.
Yeah. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2287.
And then I need to go track down a fiscal, so I'll be back.
Which one is that? You're off of? Which bill is this? Yes, please, counsel.
All right. House Bill 2287, the Dash One amendments, which you should have in your packets, is the revenue raising package from the Judicial Department. Ledge Council just informed me right before the hearing that they did determine it's a revenue raising measure requiring a 3/5 majority, so they reissued a Dash Two that only makes that change, which we'll get to you as soon as we can. The bulk of the 50-odd pages, which we just got this morning, details the increases in fees, and I've attached also a chart for you that the Judicial Department provided. The revenue is raised from creating new fees and service charges, increasing existing fees, and or increasing base fine violation fees. And the total is projected to add up to $38.8 million. You should also know that the amendments would create two new funds. It creates a judicial stabilization fund, and it changes the appropriation mechanism for some of the fines. In general, the package would propose that any new fees created be appropriated to this new stabilization fund, while increases to existing fees be appropriated to the general fund. And there is at least one exception where that the existing and new fees on certain court-collected judgments will be redirected from the general fund to the Judicial Department collections account. And the other new fund created in Section 27 is a state court technology account, and that's funded in part by a $10 assessment on many filing fees and fines.
She's raised the big fiscal we're unaware of. Is that no? This has no referral
chaos.
Actually, the summary says the speaker requests a referral.
Ways and means. Have a letter in your.
All right. Thank you.
You have a letter approving.
Why would you have
probably signed it? Okay. This is the bill that comes over from Chief Justice, and the court's asking us to do this. This bill has a referral to Ways and Means. Chair.
This is from Chief Justice Paul Domenech.
Yes, it is. And you're asking that, yes, I talked to him this morning, that we move it and get it down to Ways and Means and that where they can make any final adjustments.
Well, I just wanted to state I have a lot of confidence in what he does. He is a man of integrity and honesty, and I have a lot of faith that he's not going to be putting something like this forward, even though there's a lot of dollars there, that he doesn't need to do the job in the justice system. So I'll support it.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to echo Representative Krieger's comments. We systematically underfund the judicial department in this state. I have a deep respect and confidence in the Chief Justice. That said, this is a and I will support the bill. That said, this is a fairly significant bill that we're getting stuffing at the last minute, 54 pages. I would have appreciated had somebody discussed this with me in advance and brought this to my attention that we were had this bill here.
Chair, does this bill typically come to this committee? It strikes me as really a Ways and Means. It's
well,
a budget bill.
Came through revenue. The Judicial Committee. Normally, revenue.
Because I share Representative Barton's concern of to the extent this is policy, we really haven't had a chance to.
We have none
to review it,
pages.
And so I'm comfortable sending it to Ways and Means, but I'm not sure why it stopped here in the first place.
It had to come through a committee, and because of the late date, they just to keep it alive. So,
okay. Do I need a dash? Is a dash one
and twos?
Ledge Council just reissued the dash twos, which we don't have to you yet. They simply add the line about requiring the three-fifths majority, and it doesn't change any of the section numbers.
Do we need a suspension to do it?
Fiscal and Revenue working on their impacts. I was going to recommend that you carry it over.
We need to suspend the rules, Ken.
You want us to carry it over till Monday?
I wondered if you wanted to do that so we could get copies of the dash twos to you.
Okay. Since we don't have the dash twos before, so we'll carry this bill over into.
Do you want to go ahead and.
I'm sorry, before we do that, Kingsley, click, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator for the Oregon Judicial Department. They're passing out testimony, as was mentioned. This is a revenue bill that provides funding to keep a stabilized court system. The testimony shows that this, it says the dash one amendments, as counsel explained, they're dash two amendments that just add on the three-fifths vote requirement. They're new fees. There are approximately 23 fees affected. 11 are new fees, and I'll touch on those very quickly, and there are 12 existing fees. And then the two accounts are created as counsel went over. The purpose of the revenue stream is to be considered to support the continued operations of the state court system, and subsequent to any action by this committee that the bill is amended before to the Ways and Means to be considered with our budget. The Chief Justice has been in discussions with these amendments as well as other revenue concepts with legislative leadership and with the co-chairs of judiciary. And these solutions will help prevent the dismantling of the system if you need general fund background and backup. The Chief has a budget policy objective. I've provided that in the testimony. He wants a judicial branch of government that carries out its core constitutional and statutory duties in an effective manner. He believes that His objective should be to have the courts open and accessible every day for business, that they should process those cases in a reasonable timeline to maintain public safety, protect children and families, and establish and protect property rights and economic transactions, and that there should be a sufficient administrative infrastructure to support those core operations. These amendments raise approximately $35.3 million in various forms. 5.4 of it would go to the technology account. About 15.7 would go to a judicial stabilization fund to help provide for the functions. And then other parts go to the general fund, the CFAA account, and various entities who depend on the court judgments to provide a revenue stream. Where did these fees come from? Just a quick explanation. Many of these suggestions came from the courts themselves and other interest groups. The chief looked at those fees that are currently not charged, that exist in other court systems, that use court resources to provide them, and that may seem to make some logical sense that there would be a fee for it. He also looked at fee levels that could be adjusted with a meaningful adjustment so that the resources needed to provide them were somewhat commensurate, and that also it was within reason for the user and as compared to those in other state court systems. He wanted to keep the volume of changes narrow rather than every single fee that the courts have, which is why he looked at 11 new fees and 12 existing fee adjustments. He also tried to look at the impact on access to justice and, as I mentioned before, something about the cost recovery equivalent of what it takes a court to do this. So how much does this money raise? It raises equivalent of about 10% of the general fund portion of judicial. And so he thought that was an appropriate level to look at to send down to Ways and Means after you had any questions about particular fees or issues related to that. And I can answer any questions if you had on specifics. Council handed out the summary of what fees are affected, and then it has a description. She also, I believe, handed out some information. When were they last changed? How many do we have in our court system, and more detail behind that.
Okay, and it's my plan, since we don't actually have the physical dash two, we'll have to set this over to Monday.
Okay.
Before we vote on it, is there any questions, Representative Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to support the proposal as well. I think that once the depth of the financial crisis really hit all of us in the Public Safety Subcommittee, the Chief Justice mid-session really dove in and worked on a proposal that he has informed the Ways and Means Committee members about, and is, I think, finally now at the point where he's ready to move on it. I think my assumption is he would have gotten it to us much sooner, except that they were working on it just in the last, as the scope of the crisis has evolved. And so I think it makes sense to get it down to Ways and Means and continue work on it.
Okay, thank you. Any further? Okay.
Any work session to announce?
Yes. Open a work session on House Bill 2287, and we will carry it over until Monday, April 27th. Thank you. Okay. Open a work session at House Bill 2682.
And members of the committee, 2682 is the bail bonds bill that we heard the Dash 1 amendments, I believe, earlier in the week. We do not yet have an official fiscal statement issued, but we have Mr. Berkovian and Mr. Taylor here to speak on the fiscal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I find myself in the unusual position of sitting at the witness table. For the record, my name is Bill Taylor. Yesterday, Rick Berkovian, who's one of the chief administrator for committee services, sent to me the Dash 2 amendments and asked me, because this requires a joint interim judiciary committee to conduct a study on the feasibility and advisability of instituting a system of commercial surety bail in the state of Oregon. And then it goes on that the committee shall do, and you can read it, it has six different areas of this aspect and compare it to the national system. This is not an area that is my expertise. Last session, some of you may remember, on the Public Safety Strategies Task Force, we had a similar study in comparing Oregon's programs, evidence-based programs, for effectiveness. And in doing so, what we did is we looked to the state of Washington for what they did in national standards. What we had to do was hire an outside consultant. In that case, it was Echo Northwest. So when I was asked what the cost was, I went to that. We had $100,000 allocated for that. We had two people bid. One bid at approximately $75,000. The other one bid at $99,999. So I, to be conservative and to be safe, said $100,000. Well, just before lunchtime, I received a call from Paul Romain, who told me that I had exaggerated the numbers. And I do not like it when my veracity is questioned in that way. And I have come before you to tell you how we arrived at the numbers and how I gave the numbers to Mr. Berkovian. And it was done so based on what is done by Echo Northwest. And going back to my skills, I'm an attorney. I do not deal that with numbers. I'm not even sure how you would do something like this. And in my experience, it would be like we had with Echo Northwest. You'd have to hire economists. I don't believe that we have any economists on our staff. And this would be something that the only way that I could see that this study could be done as requested by here would be by outside consultants.
For the record, Rick Berkovian, we did consult on this along with Sandra Ryerson, who's our Director of Financial Services for Legislative Administration. Although I don't believe we've received back the official fiscal impact from Legislative Fiscal Office, they also concurred that this would be on the same scale as our Public Safety Strategy Task Force, which we actually end up spending $77,000 on. So in theory, this would probably be more in a range of somewhere between $75,000 and $100,000 if it's on the same scope and scale as the Public Safety Strategy Task Force, which I concur based on the provisions here. We do not have the resources within Judiciary or Committee Services to conduct this depth of study.
Okay. I see Mr. Romain is in the room, and it was in my discussion with him, it was his understanding that it wasn't asking, although it appears from reading the written testimony it does. So thank you very much for putting that on the record. Mr. Romain, if you would come up for a minute, please. And just talk about what you think it says. We seem to have miscommunicated an issue here, that it's believed this would require a study which would require the accountants and also.
Well, my reading of the Dash 1 Amendment is that this would require a study to be conducted on, I believe, five or six different areas, and then the expertise of, I believe, Mr. Bocomi and Mr. Taylor were just speaking to the committee about how that would be done. I mean, I do agree that this amendment requires an interim committee to examine the cost and structure of all of these different elements. As far as what the money amount is, I can't speak to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I represent the American Bail Coalition, and I guess this is the problem when you get amendments right before the committee is meeting on the amendments. What was intended by the amendments is simply for the interim judiciary committee to look at the concept of surety bail and bring it back to the next special session either in February or regular session. It was not to do a massive economic study, but what was listed in it are things you should look at, and they're things that everybody should look at in making an intelligent decision. That information would be brought to you by the industry, by opponents, everybody, but it's not to set up a massive infrastructure. In fact, the whole reason that we did the study this way was to not have much of a fiscal impact, but at least move the bill on so we could actually see if this is something that should be brought back into the state of Oregon. The first time we find out about this is today, and in fact, I just happened to be walking by the committee and didn't. I had heard you had carried this over till Tuesday, and so I was heading outside, happened to see a member of the committee who said, "We're hearing your bill now," and I went, "Oh my God!" and I jumped back in. Our intent, if the language of that amendment is too broad, it should be narrowed down. Unfortunately, because of time, it would have to be done in the Senate. We know the Senate chair is very much in favor of this, and it would be narrowed down so that there isn't the demands for an economic study of the whole system. It's simply things you should look at in making any kind of intelligent decision if you're going to bring back the concept of surety bail in this state. There's absolutely no intent to break the bank, believe me. Nobody's more aware of that than me.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I regardless of whether this legislature passes a bill along the lines of the proposed amendments to 2682, I am committed to working with proponents of this bill to study, I think, in the intent they and look at these various elements and see if this is not something that in the next legislative assembly should consider bringing back to Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Romaine. We'll carry this over till Tuesday and take a look at it, and we'll see if we can.
Right. Mr. Chair, we would narrow it down as much as it needs to be narrowed down so that there is not a fiscal impact. It's just, how do you sort of force the committee to look at this very important issue during the interim? That's it.
Yeah, we will look at it and see if we can't move it, and I will also speak with Senator Prozanski.
Great.
So we can move it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So hearing?
I carried over.
Yeah, it's carried. We already carried it over for Tuesday. Open a work session on House Bill 2403.
Last bill of the meeting, we have House Bill 2403, was first heard back in February, and then again, I believe, earlier this week. It authorizes the forfeiture of a vehicle with a hidden compartment. The original bill authorized the forfeiture of a vehicle with a hidden compartment. You've now adopted the dash two, so it simply set out the procedure by which the hidden compartment would be removed and how it would be funded. We have the paperwork back. There's a minimal expenditure impact, no statement issued, and no revenue statement. So.
We don't have on the dash two.
We've already, no, everything's in.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move House Bill 2403 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2403 as amended to the floor of the due pass. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I'll vote the bill here, but I'm not certain I will on the floor. I want to take a look at what I think it really says, and whether we covered properly hidden compartments, which people actually have built into vehicles for legal reasons.
This covers the case for crime, right? Isn't it? Crime has to be a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify that with counsel, probably, that this would allow for the forfeiture of a vehicle regardless of whether or not any drugs were found in the vehicle?
No. Representative Shields, going back to the conversation, I think actually Representative Smith asked the exact same question last time, if I remember. So it's a common question I've come across. The original bill did create a new provision for forfeiting a vehicle. This does not do that. All of this says is that once the vehicle has been forfeited, either criminally or civilly, and if it's criminally, it's either going to be through a plea petition or through having met the burden of a reasonable doubt, then once it's in the agency's possession. If it has a compartment that's been used for criminal purposes, they have to remove it, and it just lays out how they can pay for removing it, essentially, or be reimbursed for the cost of removing. That's all it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Smith? Excused.
Excused.
Aye. Aye. Representative. Motion carries. Representative Olson will be the carrier. Any further business coming forward today? Adjourned.